Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have Donald Trump fulfilling his campaign pledge in ordering the construction of his famous border wall against Mexico. Donald Trump signed an executive order on Wednesday mandating that the great, big, beautiful wall, which he bragged about on the campaign trail, finally take the first step towards fruition. It'll still take a lot of time, resources, and logistics to build it, but the border fortification is one of his most famous electoral platforms, and love it or hate it, it is a welcome sign to see a politician finally carrying through on their promises so soon after entering office. After all, everybody remembers how Obama said he closed down Gitmo after winning the presidency, yet 8 years later, it's still up and running. There's of course a lot of skepticism about whether Trump will ultimately be able to deliver on this promise, but I'm fairly confident that he won't disappoint. Trump and his team know how big of a problem unlimited illegal immigration is to American society, economy, and security. And it was his dramatic appeal to even make Mexico pay for this wall which won him so much popular support at the beginning of his presidential candidacy. Moreover, from an international strategic angle, Trump displayed a lot of prudent foresight in announcing that he's carrying through on his pledge so soon after taking office, since it'll add yet another layer of pressure to Mexico in the run-up to the planned trilateral NAFTA renegotiation talks in the coming future. These will be the most pivotal international talks in recent history for Mexico, because of the enormity of what's at stake. The Mexican economy has been growing at an impressive rate over the past couple of years, with most of its trade being conducted with the U.S., but with China taking up an ever-increasing share, however incremental it is at this moment. NAFTA is the cornerstone of Mexico's economy, and its renegotiation in favor of American workers will negatively impact on the country, potentially depressing growth rates and further harming the already weakened peso. Compounded with Trump's plans to deport 2 to 3 million violent illegal immigrants in the near future, many of whom statistics suggest are of Mexican origin, it's possible that a socioeconomic crisis might break out as these people return to their homeland without any available work, thus compelling some of them to join the notorious drug cartels and spiking the already high rate of violence in the country. The resultant socioeconomic unrest might even lead to radical political change if it's not quelled, which could shift the Mexican government either towards the hard left or the far right, with the latter being the Washington-encouraged trend over the past couple of years through Operation Condor 2.0. I hate to say it, but the harsh truth is that Mexico has been taking advantage of the U.S.'s neoliberal marketplace and broken immigration system for so long that the country's stability has become dependent on it. But with Trump determined to put America first in everything that he does, it's bound to lead to a series of systemic shocks in Mexico which will severely test its leadership and put the country's whole future on the line in the coming 4 to 8 years. The next one up is the Taliban's message to Trump that he should give up the war in Afghanistan and withdraw American troops from the country. It looks like everyone's sending their official messages to Trump now that he's president, and that includes the Taliban, America's enemies ever since the 2001 war in Afghanistan. The group rightly told Trump that it's about time that the occupation troops leave the country and allow its people to resolve their domestic problems on their own, but I doubt that he's going to listen to them. After all, his Secretary of Defense is General Mad Dog Mattis, who isn't known for being soft on any Islamic groups, whether terrorist or not, nor is his National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn. Another thing to figure into the equation is the influence of Henry Kissinger and his deep state disciples, who understand the balance of power significance that the American occupation of Afghanistan holds and given the U.S. a strategic military presence at the crossroads of Central, South, and West Asia right near the Russian, Chinese, and Iranian borders. Accepting that it's unlikely that the U.S. will make major drawdowns in Afghanistan, let alone a full withdrawal, it's still pertinent to talk about the complex conflict resolution process ongoing in the country nowadays. The U.S. and Indian-backed Kabul government is extremely unpopular and unrepresentative of the Afghan people. And whether one likes it or not, the Taliban are the only realistic replacement and actually have the support of many people in the war-torn country. However, since they're legally designated as a terrorist group, they can't participate in elections and speedily resolve Afghanistan's prolonged conflict. And the U.S. is actually happy with the state of affairs no matter what it publicly says. Interestingly, however, Russia and China, enlightened by regional leader Pakistan, have started singing a different tune to this group, and now realize that the Taliban is an indispensable part of the political solution. It wasn't just their Pakistani partner that got them to see the light, but simple pragmatics in the sense that the Taliban is the most powerful and effective bulwark against Daesh's regional territorial expansion into South and Central Asia. The U.S. occupation forces aren't helping to fight this group, and instead, it's growing at a very fast pace in spite of the American presence, raising legitimate concerns that the U.S. plans to encourage the relocation of the world's worst terrorist group to this strategic trans-regional space once it's finally expelled from the Syrak battle space. Therefore, it's no surprise then that the third trilateral meeting between Russia, China, and Pakistan took place in Moscow at the end of December, which I wrote about in a column for Sputnik at the time. If the U.S. won't admit defeat and withdraw from Afghanistan, intending instead to stay and prolong the destabilization emanating from the country, then the tripartite of Russia, China, and Pakistan need to work on parallel solutions which incorporate Iran at some point and counteract the dangerous American strategy in this pivotal space. Third in our countdown is Netanyahu's direct address to the Iranian people and the real reason behind this public relations stunt. Last week, Netanyahu released a curious Facebook video statement all of a sudden talking about just how much he loves the Iranian people, which prompted Tehran to lash right back out at him and say that he should stop the massacres against the Palestinian people. The Iranians didn't do this because they're insecure about a foreign leader addressing their people, but rather because of the inflammatory remarks that Netanyahu said about them. The Israeli leader went on and on about how great the Iranian people are, which is true, but contrasted their positive attributes with many of the negative ones which he says characterizes their government, inferring that Israel would support them if they rise up to overthrow it. Obviously, what he's trying to do is sow unrest in the country and inspire a Green Revolution 2.0 sometime around Iran's upcoming May elections. As could be expected, most Iranians don't care what Netanyahu has to say about their country and have absolutely zero respect for him. But the problem is that there are many terrorist groups targeting the country which are not only receptive to Netanyahu's overtures, but might even be working on behalf of Israeli interests. After all, Iran and Israel are hated rivals of one another, and Tel Aviv has consistently said that it opposes the Tehran authorities to the point of outright favoring their overthrow. In view of this, it can't be ruled out that Netanyahu's video statement wasn't an outreach to Iranians, but was a subtle threat to their government, hinting that terrorist groups such as the so-called People's Mujahideen of Iran and the Kurdish Democratic Party of Iran could receive covert Israeli backing in any forthcoming Green Revolution 2.0. As Tel Aviv differs from Tehran in its designation of these organizations and sees them instead as legitimate opposition groups. Another thing that we need to factor in is that the Facebook video came out just a day before Netanyahu's phone call with Trump, during which time reports said that they did discuss Iran. The new American president invited Netanyahu to visit the White House early next month, and bearing in mind that one of Trump's premier foreign policy platforms is to be tough on Iran and renegotiate or scrap the nuclear deal, it's logical that they discuss joint strategies in this regard and counteractions to Iran's response. More than likely, the hybrid war on Iran will move in the direction of unconventional warfare, capitalizing off of neo-Marxist and pro-federalist terrorist groups which want to overturn the religious republican order and turn Iran into a secular, internally partitioned patchwork of identity-diverse statelets. I don't think that it'll succeed, but then again, that doesn't mean that they won't try. So we should all interpret Netanyahu's Facebook video statement last week not as a friendly outreach of the Iranian people, but as a declaration of the regime change hybrid war, which he plans to wage against the country together with his new partner in arms, Donald Trump. Our runner-up is the Macedonian Civil Society or Association Stop Operation Soros and the global impact that this new activist group is poised to have. The Republic of Macedonia has been beset by various hybrid war destabilizations over the past couple of years as the administration of former U.S. President Barack Obama tried to overthrow the government through the contracted use of Soros-affiliated organizations. The reason behind this unstated but obvious policy was that the country is an irreplaceable transit state for facilitating Russian and Chinese megaprojects in the region, in particular, the planned Balkan Stream gas pipeline and Balkan Silk Road high-speed rail network, respectively. With the defeat of his hand-picked neoliberal successor Hillary Clinton and the victory of the pragmatic businessman Donald Trump in last year's elections, there's a distinct possibility that the U.S. will enter into a series of deals with Russia and China and hashing out undeclared spheres of influence, one of which will importantly and most likely include the Balkans. With this in mind, there's a very real chance that President Trump will no longer have the U.S. rely on the massive network of Soros organizations which his predecessor wielded around the world, and which his political opponents are currently using against him and his supporters inside the American homeland. This gives hope that the series of failed NGO-led hybrid war destabilizations against the Republic of Macedonia will come to an end soon. But in order to make sure that happens, three Macedonian patriots banded together to form the civil society association Stop Operation Soros, otherwise known by its initials SOS. Nikola Serbov, Sviatin Chilimanov, and Nenad Mirtsevsky recently launched the group and invited Macedonians of all races and religions to join them in investigating the crimes of Soros-affiliated organizations over the past couple of years, demanding that the U.S. take accountability by immediately stopping its support to this shadowy network. The latest news about SOS is that they're officially requesting that the U.S. State Department review and disclose all U.S. aid funding for Soros groups in Macedonia, even raising the point that American taxpayer funds were scandalously and potentially illegally disbursed to a former communist-era police informant suspected of human rights violations, who incidentally was the longtime head of the Open Society Foundation in the country. The SOS movement has already generated enormous global support in the alternative media community and has long gone viral ever since its announcement, suggesting that other organizations might finally have the courage to sprout up elsewhere in the world and partner with the original group, possibly leading to a worldwide anti-Soros movement. It's important to state that SOS is not anti-American, nor is it anti-NGO. It's just anti-Soros, and is against the destabilizing influence of politically minded NGOs and the sovereign affairs of host countries, which is a powerful rallying cry for the populations all across the world which have been victimized by the billionaires' network. Funnily enough, it might turn out in hindsight that one of the tiniest countries to ever be targeted by Soros ends up taking down one of the largest shadow networks to ever spread its tentacles across the world. At our top spot, we've got German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier declaring that Trump's presidency signifies the end of the 20th century world order. He came out with his remarks over the weekend in an opinion piece for Bild, in which he notably said, quote, "As always, when power changes hands, there are uncertainties, doubts, and questions about the course the new leadership will take. But in these times of a new global disorder, it is about more, and there is a lot at stake today. With the election of Donald Trump, the old world of the 20th century is over for good." End quote. It's understandable why this totalitarian Europhile would be upset, since Trump has come out on numerous occasions as a strong opponent of the EU's authoritarian centralization and cultural Marxism. It's understandable why this totalitarian Europhile would be upset, since Trump has come out on numerous occasions as a strong opponent of the EU's authoritarian centralization and cultural Marxism, and Steinmeier is the top diplomat for the bloc's hyper-liberal leader. Taking aside the personal motivation and obvious fear-mongering behind his comments, the German foreign minister actually touches upon a few good points, and it's that the post-World War II and post-Cold War orders of bipolarity and unipolarity, respectively, are over with, heralding in the emerging multipolar world order. It's still far, far from a done deal, and Washington and its allies will stop at nothing to regain their power. But what's most important to note is that a clear ideological divide has developed between the U.S. and the EU. The U.S. is reverting back to its conservative roots, while the EU is going wild with liberalism. Ordinarily, this wouldn't present a major problem for the U.S.'s hegemony, but the world is presently in the midst of many ongoing paradigm shifts, and a lot of bad blood has been spilled over the past year across both sides of the Atlantic. The ruling EU establishment was convinced that Donald Trump had no chance whatsoever at winning the presidential election, which is why they sided so overtly with Clinton and her camp. But now that he prevailed against all presumable odds, they're in hot water, but are stupidly doubling down on their rhetoric and positions. Instead of moderating their ideological experiment just a little bit in order to go with the flow and decentralize to satisfy the demands of many Europeans, they decided to dig in and accelerate the EU's totalitarian centralization, both in political and social terms as well. So-called political correctness, which is a vicious form of censorship in Western society, is worse than it's ever been before, and unelected bureaucrats are fighting tooth and nail against elected domestic politicians in preventing Brexit-like referendums. the growing division between the US and EU and between the EU elite and the masses is encouraging the conditions for a series of tectonic shifts in the Western geopolitical space, which used to be the center of global gravity after the end of the Cold War. And as it becomes ever more destabilized by its very own hand, it naturally becomes an even greater threat to global stability and world peace. So guys, there you have it. This wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown. And as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for listening to my program. Hope you guys have a good weekend and that you'll tune in again next week. Thank you. Bye.